Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you animal facts, wildlife updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. One question animal lovers always get asked as a kid is, so, do you want to be a vet? And for me, the answer was always, nah, not really. And for a long time, that was also the same answer for Dr. Jess French, until after completing her zoology degree, she went on to work in the world of veterinary. Highs, lows, and challenges, Jess tells us all about life as a vet and some unique moments she faced while completing veterinary work in different zoos around the world. But when Jess isn't saving or treating animals, she's instilling the love of them through her words. This year alone, Jess has 3 books coming out, and a big focus on these is waste reduction and sustainability. We talk about the steps to take and how even the smallest change can have a huge impact. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy the show. Hi Jess, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining me on Into the Wild. How are you doing? Are you all good?
Yes, busy day, chaotic, but I'm very happy to be here. So
awesome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, let's make this a nice part of your day for you.
Yeah,
doesn't
definitely.
Have to be chaotic at all. Thanks so much for joining me on the show. I've really been excited to chat to you. I know we've been trying to plan this for a while. For my listeners, for the benefit of everyone around the world that listens to the show, could you just explain to me who you are and what you do?
Yeah, I'm Jess. I wear lots of different hats, really, all about saving the planet, I guess, ultimately. I'm a vet by trade. I work with dogs and cats as well as all sorts of incredible zoo animals. I've had the opportunity to work with lots of different animals, actually. I'm also an author. I write books about the planet, about animals, and about how we can protect the world. And I'm a zoologist and a mum. Yeah, I do lots of different things.
Now I understand what you mean when you say chaotic day.
Yeah.
That's a lot of things to juggle. So a question that I ask my guests right at the top, because it's something I'm always interested to hear about, is how did your thirst for wildlife, nature and animals and all that stuff, how did that first begin for you?
I think it began with my pets. I had a lot of pets as a kid. I had dogs and cats and rabbits and guinea pigs. And then later on, I also had some more exotic pets. So I've had snakes and lizards and all sorts of insects as well.
Nice.
And tarantulas and scorpions.
Oh, you've had a tarantula?
Yeah,
I've always wanted one. And no one I've ever, let me use a phrase, cohabited with, has never let me have one.
When I wanted to take it to uni, none of my flatmates would let me.
Really?
I had to stay at home, yeah.
I don't know what it is. I love animals that terrify me, for a start. I don't know what this weird obsession I have is. But I've always wanted to just have one, just to have one nearby, and I think maybe get rid of my fear a little bit. But I'm never allowed. What was it like having one to care for?
I mean, they're not, once you've got their conditions right, and the beginning setup is quite a, it's quite important to make sure that you've got the right conditions. But then once that's set up, it's pretty easy, really. It also depends what type of tarantula you have, but some of the sort of more easy to care for ones, you just sling in some crickets every now and again, and that's about all it takes.
See, that's easy. I just need to tell people the husbandry guidelines and maybe they'll let me have one. Maybe that's what I need to
exactly,
do.
Exactly, yeah.
But sorry, I interrupted. So it was based on your pets and then becoming a bit more exotic that got you more into it, I guess.
Yeah, so I think that was one side of it, was probably pets at home. Not as in the shop, like,
there are other shops available.
And then the other side of it was just being outside all the time.
Yeah.
I used to go bug hunting with my dad all the time. I was always in the woods and just playing outside and learned about the outside world and the natural world and the animals that live there in that way. So yeah, kind of two pronged, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
But everything was always about animals.
Yeah,
my toys were animal themed. Everything was animals.
So. It's a very easy way to draw people in from a kid, isn't it? Because so much of it is just animal themed, whether it's clothing, like you said, toys.
Yeah.
Books and stuff
like
that, so it's not really a surprise that's where it starts for most people.
No, but it's funny because I don't know if it's natural, because My little girl, she loves dolls. I never had any dolls. I wasn't interested in them at all. All of my toys were like cuddly animal toys. And she's not like interested in them, like all about dolls. So I don't know if you're born with it or I don't know.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
She's got loads of animals around her all the time as well. I don't know.
But then that's the same with me, I guess, because like my mum and dad liked animals, but it was never in my face. It was never like they,
yeah.
I mean, we went on walks, we did stuff like that, but I was still an indoors child as well. But there was something about, I always say it was something to do with my nan's house. My nan had a bungalow with a circular garden backed onto the forest with horses out the back. And I think that's where it was nurtured out more. I think it's, I always believe it's something we all have. It depends on where the nurture is. I don't know. It's a really hard one because, like you said, but then your daughter has not gone for
I mean,
that.
Don't get me wrong. She does love animals.
Yeah.
She loves things as well as animals. Yeah. She has a singular obsession.
There we go. That's the difference, isn't it? She's not obsessed like we are. Like.
She's probably got the healthy balance.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Good on her for a healthy balance. So, like you said, having a pet tarantula and going down the more exotic route, and it's clear from the books you've written as well, you're interested in the world of bugs. What was it about insects that kind of drew you in?
I suppose in the beginning they're the most accessible thing that there is. I mean, they're weird and they're amazing and they're like tiny little monsters.
Yeah.
But they're everywhere. So anywhere you go, just about, you can find some sort of mini beast or other. So it's a really easy one to observe them in their natural habitat and to see some of the incredible behaviours that they do. And yeah, I think they're, I guess, firstly because they're accessible, secondly because they're weird. And I think I kind of liked the fact that it freaked people out that I was into bugs as well.
Yeah.
So the more that people were like, ugh, the more it made me want to know more about them and be more interested in them, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, that
I
makes
like
a lot of sense.
That ick factor.
It's nice to have the underdog, isn't it? To, like, support them. Like,
yeah,
if they're not
exactly.
Liked.
And then I suppose as well, when I learned, so first it was just the bugs themselves, and then as I learned how important they are for the world, I mean, they literally run the world. The world couldn't run without the important services that they provide.
Yeah.
I was just like, you guys, you're amazing.
Now stop killing each other in weird ways so people love you more.
Yeah.
Do you have a favourite bug or insect or mini beast?
Oh man, I don't know. Like literally off the top of my head, I'm going to say bees, but just because we've been watching bees all day on our lavender plant outside today. But I mean, I love them all.
I know. Did you know what? I speak about bees and wasps a lot in my comedy. And the reason, and I always say, like, the reason why people like bees and people are more likely to be a bit averse to wasps, and the only difference is that bees are fluffy. That's the only reason. Because they've got the fluff, we're a sucker for it, the humans,
yeah.
We love it. And that's the main reason.
It's,
when you look at them, you're like, they are beautiful. Like, they are.
Yeah. They're super cute, aren't they?
Oh, they really are. Oh, God,
you'd
want to
give a bee a cuddle. I don't know if you'd want to give a wasp a cuddle.
The thing is, if a bee was a Labrador size, we would cuddle it.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
You wouldn't with a wasp.
That would be a bit freaky, though, wouldn't it?
I mean, it'd be terrifying. But there'd be people out there that did. There'd be, like, Bee King, like Tiger King out there. There'd be a thing.
It'd probably be me.
You'd open up this big world. She's got over 2,000 bees. Did you think you've done a lot of work with children, and a lot of your books are that way focused as well. Do you find that children are more interested in bugs and insects when they're learning or getting into nature?
I think most kids love bugs. The thing I find mostly, because I do quite a lot of stuff where the parents are there as well, and it's usually the parents that are the ones saying, don't touch that, it's dirty or it's dangerous, or, you know, the kids always seem keen. And definitely the kids that are more wary are the ones whose parents are really, really anxious about them getting dirty or, you know, being frightened by these creatures. So, yeah, I think there is something innate about kids being interested in bugs, definitely.
Yeah. Have you seen a change in the last few years of when you're, you know, even in your writing or when you're communicating with people? Have you seen a change for the love of bugs at all?
I don't think I've seen a change in the love of bugs. I think kids have always been fascinated by bugs when I've shown them. But what I have seen a change in is their awareness of what we're doing to the planet and the things we can do to change it. Yeah, and sort of their role as stewards of the environment, or you know, how they can actually make a tangible difference to the world. That certainly wasn't something kids had a handle on when I first started giving talks, and I think they really are starting to get it now. I mean, they're amazing. Some of them, they're really knowledgeable.
And is it when we say from children, what ages are we talking when we're seeing that awareness come through?
Oh, from really, really small. I mean, I know primary school kids who are turning out the bins, and sometimes it's not really helpful, but they're trying to, you know, separate the recycling from the landfill waste. And, you know, I think really small kids are taking in this message now, as well, all the way up through to teenagers.
That's amazing that primary age are having that level of alertness to it.
Yeah, definitely.
That's incredible. So you also said, let's talk about what one of your other strings to your on your bow is, you're also a veterinarian. Was this a line of work that you always wanted to go down? Because it's something that's very common when we say, if anyone says, as growing up, I'm an animal lover, the first question all the time is, do you want to be a vet? That's always what people ask. Was that something that you always knew you wanted to go down?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, as a kid, I sort of fluctuated between wanting to be a farmer, a zookeeper, a vet, like something to do with animals, dolphin trainer, animal jobs. And then I did settle on vet. But when I did my work experience, I got a bit bored, I think, because it was all inside and I wasn't getting, you know, to go out and do the natural world stuff. It was very much pet focused. So I didn't actually, in the end, I went and did zoology at uni first and only came back to being a vet later. And I came back to being a vet later because I decided I wanted to go to Africa and be a gorilla vet.
Amazing.
I went back to vet school with the you're getting the idea. I get these singular obsessions with the sole aim of being a gorilla vet. But then I graduated and then I had my kids, and it seemed a little bit less appropriate to be carting the family off to Africa to be a gorilla vet now.
Do you think that will come back?
That's put on the back burner for now.
Do you reckon that's something that you'll get back to?
Oh, I really don't know. I mean, if you would have told me 10 years ago half of the things that I've ended up doing with my life, I wouldn't have had a clue, so maybe.
I'm excited to hear what the next obsession fort line is. I can't wait.
Yeah, we'll see.
I've never really had a chance to speak to a vet like yourself, kind of on an interview style, and I'm really interested because I've worked with vets in the zoo world, and I see it as such a challenging and such a demanding job.
Yeah.
You know, on any level, really, even if you're just working from domesticated animals, or to the exotic side. But what are some of the main challenges you have to face with in the veterinary world?
It's really different depending on what kind of veterinary work you're doing. I suppose in all spheres of veterinary, for me anyway, one of the most difficult things is the emotional side of it.
Yeah.
Because obviously you have to do some sad things, and you're quite often dealing with very unwell animals. And so with the small animal side of it, the dog and cat side of it, there's the emotion of the owners as well, which can be really a lot to deal with. For me, probably the emotional side of it has the biggest, weighs heaviest on my shoulders.
Really?
But then if we're talking about the practical side of it, certainly in zoo medicine, it's all really difficult because in the first place, you don't really often know a lot about these animals, because, you know, what you're doing might not ever have been done before, or only been done by a few other vets. So there's not tons of literature that you can read about, and you certainly most of the time are not doing something you've physically ever done before. Because of the nature of the job, it's quite random stuff, what's going to go wrong with what weird animal you've got in your zoo. And then there's also the fact that some of the animals want to bite your head off, or some of them are actually quite dangerous, so they're getting close to them. And some of them, I mean, primates, I'm saying I want to work with gorillas, they're just so intelligent. They know if you're going to dart them, they know what you're trying to do, and they'll catch the dart and throw it back at you. So that's more a chimp thing to do, actually, than a gorilla. But that's super clever. So lots of challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. And you specialise in primates. So that, I mean, what kind of scenarios are you faced with in the vet world with primates? What kind of things might you get called to?
Yeah, I mean, as a vet, I haven't done heaps of primate stuff, actually. The primate focus is more in my interest and my zoological knowledge. But the primates that I have had to deal with, I have had to castrate a gibbon because it had a hormonal problem. There have been some really sad things I've had to go to, animals that are, you know, at the end of their lives. I've had to do that sort of treatment. And then they're often fighting, so there's quite a lot of wounds to deal with.
No, of course, yeah. I mean, I've worked with gorillas, and I know.
Yeah.
It's usually louder than it is.
It's
usually louder than it is more severe, but you sometimes turn up to a lot of blood.
And they're actually, their ability to heal is amazing.
Most
of the time, you do try and just leave wounds as much as possible to heal on their own.
Yeah.
Occasionally, you do have to intervene, but you try not to do that because it can upset the whole social balance. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's a big job getting in there and darting them and treating them.
Well, that's the thing as well. It's something the public used to ask us a lot. I mean, we had a really successful breeding group of lowland gorillas, and then you'd have a big scrap for some reason, you know, the male has not done something he was meant to do, that kind of normal thing.
Yeah.
And then it's all kicked off. And people would ask us, are you not going to intervene? And I'd kind of look at them and go, are you mad? Like, no way am I going to intervene with that. Like, they have to sort that out. If I go in there or try to intervene, I'm putting my life, I can't do that. Like, we will intervene when absolute necessary, but not in any way of going in there. And I think the public had this thought of going, if there's a scrap, we go in and go, all right, ding, ding, round two, let's separate. And you can't do that.
No, definitely not. And, you know, in the wild, those things would happen and nature would take its course. And you kind of have to be aware. You have to let that happen and play out as it would in the wild a lot of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. What kind of other animals? Have you done much other work with zoo animals or other exotics and stuff like that?
Yeah, so what sorts of things have I done? Probably my most fun or most incredible thing that I feel like I've done was ultrasounding a snow leopard.
Oh, wow.
Just getting that close to such an iconic animal.
Yeah.
Because
that must have been quite emotional just to see. When you say ultra, was that for pregnancy?
Yeah.
And it was?
No, it wasn't.
Oh, it wasn't. Oh, God, that would have been incredible moment for you to see that. But that was still getting that close to a cat. What was that feeling like to actually get side on side with them?
Oh, just amazing.
Yeah.
I know it's stupid, but like to stroke their fur and it's just amazing. And to see the power, their muscles and just incredible.
But like you said, it's a situation which not many are in. And, you know, even people that study them in the wild, you never really get close to it if you ever see them at all. So to have that moment must have been amazing.
There's also the sort of adrenaline, though, of, please don't wake up, because if you wake up right now, I can see how big your teeth and claws are.
Yeah, it's a real Jurassic Park moment, isn't it? Just like the passed out T-Rex going, this is great, but don't wake up, please. You released a book that I really would like to talk about as well. You've released many books, but one book you released last year was called What a Waste. Can you tell us a bit about this book?
Yeah, so it's about kind of the mess that we're making of the planet, mostly talking about waste, rubbish, recycling, what happens to our rubbish when we're finished with it, and ways that we can deal with that waste better, I suppose.
Yeah. So when we look at like dealing with domestic waste, what kind of things, like, what can we be doing day to day to reduce or to manage our waste better in the average home, I guess?
Yeah, so I think you touched on something really important there, which is ultimately the best thing we can do is to reduce the amount of rubbish that we're producing in the first place.
Yeah.
So trying not to buy anything that is going to be thrown away straight away, so single-use plastic.
Yeah.
Trying to buy things in bulk, or it's difficult at the moment because I guess a lot of people are doing deliveries and click and collects, and so the plastic usage, I imagine, has has gone up a lot recently. But, you know, in non-lockdown circumstances, it's things like taking your mesh bags to put your fruit and veg in and getting loose fruit and veg. Not eating things out of a tub that's going to be thrown away straight away, but getting something in a large, or making stuff yourself is ideal from the raw ingredients, because then you cut right back on the plastic. Or if you can't do that, then looking at the labels and seeing whether it can be recycled or whether you could reuse it. So yeah, that's the first thing, is reducing the amount that you produce in the first place. The second best thing you can do is disposing of your waste in a responsible way, so recycling it if it's able to be recycled. Or actually, before that, the thing that would be better than that would be reusing it, so keeping a tub at home and using it again and again to store things. And then ultimately, you know, some things are going to have to go to landfill, but it's trying to avoid how much goes into that pile at the end of the day.
And this is something I've spoken a lot about over the last year. Before lockdown, I was almost plastic free. There was a couple more things, and I'd gone from room to room and gone, that doesn't need to be disposed of ever. You know, from razors to toothbrushes, you know, that can all be managed. And whenever I try and have the chat, and I'm guessing you've probably been faced with the same barrier, is when I talk to people about this, the first thing I'm met with is, it's just not available where we live. You just can't refill it. There's no way around here that does loose fruit and veg and stuff. I usually just get Google out and Google their local area and go, yeah, there's five places right there. How do you deal with that kind of instant barricade from people?
Well, it's really hard to change habits. And so the first thing people will do is, it can be, if they're not completely on board, to try and make excuses. And I think, you know, it's hard at the moment because in a lockdown situation, the waste thing is really hard. But I suppose that's why I try and target children before they form those habits. Because it can be really powerful if for the parents of those children, if they hear their children explaining why it's important and also giving the solution to get around that issue, it can be really powerful to hear that coming from your own child, you know. It hits, I think, in a different way to just someone on the telly or another adult telling you. And if we can talk to these children before those habits even form, it's much easier to start doing it in the right way than to change a lifelong habit.
Yeah, that's very true. If you can nip it in the bud before it even starts.
Exactly,
it's a massive leap forward. And you said something there about, you explained the landfill situation, and I guess the next barrier I met with, and again, I'm sure you must have come across this in your work as well, is the next thing is, I'm just one person, what difference can I make? And that's usually the two things I get, is it's not an option, or me doing it's not going to make a difference. But how much impact really can one person have on the environment by reducing their waste?
Well, the thing is, we're billions of just one person, aren't we? So if everybody makes a change, that is a massive change. And a lot of it is to do with supply and demand as well. If the demand's not there for something, then the people who are creating those disposable, I don't know, whatever it is, are not going to continue to create so much. And it is true that a lot of the problems are on an industry level, and we do need change from higher up the chain. But definitely, if we all make a concerted effort on an individual basis, it's going to make a difference as well. And even just having the conversations as well, opening up the channels of communication. It's not just about, I mean, it's definitely about walking the walk, but it's also about talking to people. We're social creatures, right? And we're great at problem solving. So if we talk to as many people as we can, and, you know, we're discussing these issues, that's how the solutions are going to be made. And if we're talking to the right people at the right time, and the conversations that are going on all the time, you know, I feel like that's going to keep the wheels moving, and change will come eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. Another question I want to ask, and this is something, again, and I seem to always say this on the show, but I ask all my guests towards the end of the show, is if you could pass on just, you know, kind of one bit of advice to everyone regarding caring for the natural world, what would you pass on?
For me, I think what I try and get across to all the children that I work with is to infuse them with a love for the natural world, because you're not going to want to protect something if you don't care about it. So the first step of that journey is to understand and be in awe of and be in love with the incredible natural world that's out there. Because if we can build a relationship with the environment and the animals within it, then the natural progression from that is to want to protect it. And once we're in that place where we want to protect it, then I can tell you how to do that.
Yeah.
But it's much easier if that's coming from a natural desire within you to protect something that you care about.
Lockdown's affected us in many ways. I think one thing that's really opened up for me is that people have needed nature so much more. And I'm really hoping that's going to be a drive to go forward. What have you been busy? Have you been doing anything? Have you been working on anything that's upcoming in the next couple of months or anything?
Well, I've been on mum duty most of lockdown, to be honest. But my book work is still going on, and I've got three books. Well, I've had three books out this year. So one, I think, came out just before lockdown or during lockdown. I can't even remember now. That was The Book of Brilliant Bugs, which came out earlier this year.
Amazing.
And then I've got a kid's book coming out in August, which is really appropriately about slowing down and appreciating the world around us.
Oh, wow.
So it's about a little monkey that's rushing through the forest. It's her birthday, and she's trying to get her birthday party ready, and she's rushing about and trying to get everything ready, and it's all going wrong. And it's not until she meets a chilled out sloth who tells her to slow down and have a look at the world around her, that she realizes that actually her forest is amazing already. She doesn't need to do anything new. She just needs to appreciate it a little bit more.
Oh, I need to meet that sloth.
That's called Slow Down Monkey, and it's out in August. And then in October, I have a book about deforestation. So that's called Let's Save Our Planet, I think.
Oh, wow. And is that looking into global deforestation?
Yeah, so that is a whole book about deforestation, which is something that I've touched on in other books. But it was amazing to have the opportunity to look at that issue in depth over a whole book.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's incredible. What a great topic to actually start conversation about as well. I feel like sometimes that's something that happens but never gets discussed.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk about plastic recently, and there are certainly other conservation issues out there that need addressing. So
yeah, absolutely. Jess, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining me, and all
Thanks
the best,
for having me.
And good luck with your next two books. You're such a hard working person with so much going on. I hope they're a massive success for you.
Thank you.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with projects, books and shows that Jess is working on, you know what to do. Twitter and Instagram at @zoologist_Jess. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify and Podbean. You can also get in touch on social media at Into the Wild Pod, whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you'd like to hear about next on a future show. Until next time, keep well, stay safe and live the good life.